Hi, this is Glenn Mulcahy. Welcome to Love What You Play podcast. Today we'll be featuring an interview from our Youth Leadership Online event that we originally hosted in December of 2018. The full event is available online on our website for loveofthegame.ca. Our mission is to help organizations, coaches, sports leaders develop programs so kids love the game more at the end of the season than they did at the beginning. We'd love to hear any feedback or comments down below, and please share this to others in your space so that we can all work together to bring the game back to the kids, because that's where it belongs. Hope you enjoy the chat and you get some great nuggets. Thank you. Hi, this is Glenn Mulcahy, your host for Play What You Love, virtual events and podcasts. I'm really excited today to have an opportunity to talk to Brian Barlow. Came across him when I did a podcast with Ken Wilmer, who does Yellow for Yelling in Australia. And he said, "Hey, have you ever talked to Brian Barlow?" And I'm like, "No." He says, "Well, you got to check him out." So I went and did a deep dive on his Facebook page and website. And I went, "Holy 40,000 followers. And what's this guy doing?" And all this other stuff. So really excited we're having an opportunity to have a chat. He is a parent long-term sports official based in Oklahoma in the U.S., and like many people, just said enough is enough. Wanted to reverse the trends of what was happening in terms of official abuse. So he founded a Facebook page called Offside, which now has over 40,000 followers, a website, endrefabuse.com. And he has been now interviewed by many, many news agencies in the U.S., including Good Morning America. Really looking forward to our chat, and let's get at it.
Great intro, man. Glenn, that's a nice job. You did your homework.
try to. So I don't even know where to begin. But the first question I ask everybody when we started talks is just get a little bit of your background in terms of where did you grow up and what sports were you involved with as a kid, whether it be organized or unstructured free play.
Yeah, no. I grew up in a suburb of Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I was at a very young age, into soccer, and I played soccer at a high level all the way up until my early 20s, and I blew out my left knee. This is how bizarre this is. I used to be one of those guys that berated officials as a player. Like if an official didn't call what I think he should call or blew the whistle too soon or something, I was one of those guys that was running up to the official. Well, I quickly realized that I had a really bad situation with my knees, and my left knee required several surgeries. And then eventually a doctor came in and said, "Listen, your left knee is done. We have to replace it." And I was at a very young age. And so I have a titanium left knee. I had to walk away from the sport. And one of my buddies said, "You know what, you should become an official," you know, kind of like glad-handing me, like, you know, making fun of me. And I'm like, "There's no way I'd be an official." You know, I was in recovery at that point in time, and I quickly realized I missed the game significantly. I missed being around it. And so my kids got into soccer, so I started coaching. And then I realized, man, I've missed all this. I've missed being around the players and you know, the intensity of the sport. And so I did. I went and got my official's badge, and I became an official just so I could be on the pitch again, be in the game. And I quickly realized there is a true pageantry to being a soccer official, and probably honestly to being any type of official. There's a system. There's a pageantry. There's a reason why and why not on pretty much everything that there is to make a decision on. And so it was a real challenge for me to kind of understand the scope of being an official and then become the best at it that I could. And so I took it as a challenge, and I quickly started moving up the ranks of being an official. And I fell in love with it. I fell in love with the fact that I cannot perfect being an official. I cannot score 100%. I've tried, but I can't. And that's what I'm trying to convey to people is officials, the best of the best, have never scored 100% on an assessment. No matter what game they're officiating, no one's ever scored 100%. And yet we expect so much out of officials, and it's alarming the game. And so I finally said to myself, you know what? Everyone knows there's a problem. Everyone knows there's this toxic situation out there, and no one's willing to do anything about it outside of just talking about it. And so I thought, you know what? I've always been a guy of a stand-up guy. I've always been a guy to make change. I've always been a leader in my circles. And I started the Offside Page.
Wow. It's kind of an interesting story. So the officiating, when you first got started, and it's interesting, I shared out a survey that came across in the U.S. National Association of Sports Officials. They did a huge one. It was over 17,000. And when they interviewed them, why they got involved, and you kind of touched on it, the main reason they started becoming an official and continue to be official was for the love of the game, which is kind of very apropos to, you know, this, our whole website and our digital arm. And I'm kind of like, okay, how are people continuing down that path with all the abuse that's happening? Are you finding trends at the youth level particularly? And how long have you been actually at this, at the Offside and the Facebook page in terms of duration?
So I literally just started the Offside page about 2 years ago. And it started as a satire page. You know, as an official, you can't say anything. You can't really say anything to spectators. You're not supposed to speak to spectators. And so I thought, man, I hear a lot of crazy stuff as an official. You know, first off, the most basic thing in soccer is, and the most controversial, is the offside call. And yet all these people want to yell at the official, how's that offside? That's not offside. And so I would hear this constantly, and I would think, listen, people, you can't even get the fundamental wording of offside correct. It's not offside. You can't be offside on both sides of the field. It is, the official term is offside. So I can't take your argument seriously as an official if you can't even get the fundamental wording right. So I think these in my head. And so I thought, man, one of these days I'm going to make a Facebook page. I'm going to lash out. I'm going to speak out to all you crazy, uninformed people and let you know how idiotic you sound sitting on the sideline. And so I started the page as, this is what I hear as an official, and this is why we don't take you serious, because you don't know what it's like to be an official. You don't even know the basic terminology. You don't even know the basic fundamentals, the systematic approach on why we call or don't call decisions. And so it was very humorous driven. So people started liking it, and I had a little bit of a following. And, you know, again, I was very, my sense of humor is very dry and in your face, and some people like that. So it became popular as I'm the official that speaks back through the Facebook page. Well, one of my buddies sends me a video, and this was about almost 2 years ago. And he sends me a video of this lady kicking a soccer ball at a youth referee because she didn't like the decision that the youth referee made during the game. And this horrific scene breaks out. And parents yelling at youth referees, dads getting ready to fight other dads, players being pushed. I mean, just a horrific scene. And my buddy sends this to me, and he's like, man, you've got a little bit of a following on your page. You should do something with this. And I'm a motivational speaker by my natural trade professionally. And I tell companies all the time, if you really want to be noticed, if you really want to make change, if you really want to be dynamic and unique, you have to sometimes step out of your comfort zone and make a bold statement. So I thought to myself, here's my time. I have to make a bold statement. I have to do something about this. I have a platform. It's growing. I'm going to make a bold statement. So I put that video on my page, and I said, and there was no long-term vision for this. Okay. I put that video on my page, and I said, listen, if you capture referee abuse like this on this video and you send it to us and we post it on the Offside page, I'm going to give you $100. Little did I know.
That was going to cost you thousands and thousands of dollars.
Yes. But the page become viral. I've been on every kind of talk show you could imagine, every kind of broadcast news network. The page has grown. I'm now close to 50,000 followers. We now have a voice. There is tremendous conversation now about referee abuse, referee awareness. There are now talks being made about making it a felony in every state to abuse verbally or physically a youth referee. So it's crazy to think the Facebook page was literally there to basically make fun of people. And now it has become a major advocacy to referees and officials and coaches and parents who are on the side of sportsmanship instead of winning at all costs.
Yeah, and it's an evolution that's happened over the last, you know, two decades where we are up against it all the time. I just did a presentation the other day, and are you finding the attrition rates, and trying to get a sense if the U.S. attrition rates are similar to what we have in Canada? Most of the organizations, regardless of the sport, like hockey is one of the ones that a lot of people focus on because of Canada, but almost every sport group I talk to, they lose about 50% of their officials in their first year. And then on average, they're losing about 30% every year thereafter. So in Canada, like a hockey example, they have 10,000 officials, give or take, every year registered, and they're losing about 3,000 a year. Main reason is because of the abuse they're taking. And this has been a trend that's been going on for years. And yet, yes, there's been a lot of talk. There's been a lot of awareness campaigns. I mean, you're taking it from a very satirical kind of in-your-face, showing the craziness through the video stream. But has there been any real action or activation strategies how we're going to reverse these trends in the U.S. and or are the trends the same or are they even worse? Because I've seen some states are calling referee attrition like a state of emergency.
No, you well, first off, the attrition rate is very similar to what you stated in Canada. First year officials are 52%, I believe, here on stateside. And most of them are leaving because to them making $20, $25, $30, $35 on a game to get yelled at, braided, ridiculed for an hour is not worth a young person's time. I don't want to say they're not mentally strong. I just think they're mentally challenged to do something different for that $20 or $30. They're just like, why would I listen to an adult who doesn't even know the fundamentals and the basics of what I'm officiating, ridiculing me for an hour for $25. They're just going to go elsewhere. But I will say this, on stateside, I travel the country and I ref and I speak now on behalf of this topic. And I will say that I have almost everywhere I go, I will have someone or people stop me and say, listen, I used to be the guy or the girl that are in the videos and I don't want to end up on your page. And they'll say it tongue in cheek. And I go, no, I get it. No, they're like, no, seriously. I don't want to end up on your page, but I had no idea how ridiculous we look when we act like that. And so from a shaming standpoint, I think it has changed a lot of people's behavior. I think the perspective is you're in that moment and you're losing your mind. I don't think you realize how ridiculous you sound and you look. But when you see it and you're removed from that moment 24 hours or more and you see it, you're like, why?
What did I do?
Why did I say and act like that? And so it really gives a lot of people a sense of don't be that person. Now, on the flip side, we have clubs in this, and I do, I preach this. The change comes from accountability. The change comes from an expectation. I tell clubs and associations, you're in charge. This is your show. If you want people, if you want to change the dynamics of how adults behave at your youth sporting event, it starts and stops with you. You have to set an expectation. You have to say, hey, we get it. You get excited. You want to win. We get it. You want the picture with the trophy at the end of the weekend to say how great of a parent you are. We get it. But when you step onto this facility, you're going to act like A, B, and C. And if you don't, you lose the privilege of getting to see your child play the sport in which you're paying for him or her to see or play. And then you have to hold them accountable. The moment they don't do A, B, and C, and they go to D and F, then you have to be strong enough and bold enough to walk up or stand up or walk over and say, I'm sorry, you've lost the privilege today to watch your child play. And once people understand that that is a real thing, they will change. And I give this example all the time. I get the privilege of going to the Masters every year almost. And the Masters is the greatest sporting event in all of sports, specifically for those that love golf. And there are the most wealthiest, most powerful people in the premise of Augusta National every single year for 7 days. And they are told, this is how you're going to look. This is how you're going to act. This is what you can and can't say. This is how you'll behave to the players. And anything above and beyond that, that is not in the scope of what we said that you will behave like, you will be escorted off the property, and you will no longer have the right, the privilege to have a ticket to watch the Masters at Augusta. And guess what? The most powerful people in the world who aren't used to telling them what to do, they abide. And so, because I hear this argument all the time, well, Barlow, we don't want to piss off the people that pay the registration. I'm like, well, then you're going to have to accept the behavior that you're so against. If the money's so important to you, then you have to accept the consequences of the dollar. And so that's ultimately how this thing's going to change. It's grassroots driven. Sure, we have a voice. Sure, there's lots of stuff on broadcast network and on social media, but it's ultimately going to take everyone in their sport, a unified front that says to the 3,000 people that are coming this weekend to watch the first weekend of soccer, baseball, football, hockey, whatever it is. And by the way, hockey is the one sport I have the most videos from. Hockey.
You already answered one of the questions I was going to ask. So yeah. That's number one.
And I'll get into that in a second. Sure. But yeah, you got to tell those three or 4,000 people that are coming, hey, welcome. This is how you're going to behave. And if you don't, this is what's going to happen. And then you have to back it up and do it. And then once people figure that out, guess what? It's simple.
Yeah, and you know, it's ironic because if you think of a professional sporting event, if fans acted up in the stands like they do at a youth sporting event, they're evicted from the facility. I worked at BC Play Stadium for like 17 years. And when people started acting up and there was fights in the stands, and then we just basically show them the door. And they had paid money to come to see that, and they're paying quite a lot of money now to watch these events. So to do that on the youth sports front, the challenge is, who will do that? Is it the coaches? Is it the officials? Is it the board members who escort those people out of the facility? That's where the big challenge is. And we also have, you know, the vocal minority, which is 5 to 10% of the, whether it be parents, it's mainly adults. And then there's the silent majority, which are the amazing people, amazing parents, amazing coaches. And unfortunately, they're getting kind of logged into that whole lump sum. Like with your Facebook, you're pointing it at almost all parents, but it's really the ones that are acting up and are taking it beyond that fine line. So what then have some more of the organizations, are they moving the needle in another direction based on what you've done the last couple of years that are turning the corner?
Absolutely. In fact, we had a state tournament in Oklahoma who, for the first time in decades, since the committee said that they could remember, they did not have to escort one single person out of the facility. Now, they branded their facility with, if you go to stoprefabuse.com, we have signage made up that pretty much dictates, hey, this is the behavior that we accept, and if you go above and beyond, we don't allow it. But it's all over the facility. And did I lose you for a second there, Glenn?
A little bit of buffer, yeah.
Okay. So what happens is when people step on the property, there's visual evidence of, okay, I probably should watch my behavior here. First off, there's people watching. Secondly, I don't want to end up on video. And thirdly, I don't want to be escorted off the premise. And so there's already that mindset change there as they're on the property by visual evidence that this facility is not going to accept your behavior. So I have seen change, but the change isn't coming from signs. It's really coming from the DNA aspect of how a club or operation or team or association sets the standard. And so one of the main things I preach is you have to turn field marshals into basically parent coaches, people that can walk up to a parent and go, hey, I've been watching you and I get that you're excited on the game, but if I hear one more outburst from you, I'm going to have you escorted off the property. And so we almost have to give field marshals the right to eliminate cancer from the facility. And so that tool ultimately does it. You don't want to put it on the coach. The coach needs the coach. You really don't want to put it on the referee. The referee needs the ref. Can't put it on the players. Players need to play. And I'd love to tell the parents, hey, parents, you just need to cheer. You're a spectator. Just cheer. Now, listen, you don't know how many times a player will thank me. And I don't do a lot of young games anymore, but you don't know how many times I've witnessed players thanking me for having someone eliminated from the game. And oftentimes it's their own parents, or they'll apologize. Here's the deal. The players don't want you to say anything. They want to be allowed to make mistakes. They want to be allowed to have their moments. You know, so many of us parents, we're so invested in our kids because we want to have the moment with them. Well, guess what? It's not your moment. It's not. It's theirs. Win or lose, success or failure, it's their moment. They develop based on how they experience their moment. And so at the end of the day, long story short, it ultimately is going to take clubs and associations, tournament directors, empowering field marshals to eliminate any cancer that they see or witness during the events. And that's ultimately what's going to change this thing.
Yeah, and it's not going to happen overnight, but hopefully it happens sooner than later, because tolerating, right, condoning this behavior year after year after year and say it'll get better, is no, it's not going to get better unless there is some drastic, you know, measures. And a perfect example is I did a talk about 3 years ago for Vancouver Island Amateur Hockey Association, which is the cumulative regional body that I think 16 or 17 hockey associations funnel into. And this was before you founded the Offside Page about 3 years ago. The president of the IHA and the board members drafted up a letter, put it onto their website in, I think, January, February, 3 years ago, and basically proposed they were going to ban parents from the stands for a weekend. And the reason was the president was a long-term official and been involved in the hockey space for many, many years. And he was just tired of the attrition from the officials, the abuse they were taking from parents. Said, you know what, we're going to ban it from the stands for a weekend. Well, lo and behold, that little letter, we call it the letter, was on Vancouver Island. Then it got to Vancouver. Then it trickled across Canada. Then it went into the U.S. It went absolutely viral, viral. Because they were taking a stance and saying, we're going to ban parents for the weekend so that these kids could just play without that.
Did they do it?
They didn't end up doing it because the backlash they took from all the parties, whether it be Hockey Canada, BC Hockey, say, hey, you can't do this. But what it did do is it created a huge awareness, for one. And secondly, they did ban, I think it was five parents from because of their behavior at a midget level, and there was another four or five that were affected for the remainder of the season, because this happened in January. The hockey season ends traditionally in March, so it did have an effect per se. But I did the talk a year after the fact, and when I asked the president of this, of Jim Humphreys, share with me, did it have the impact that you were hoping? He goes, yes and no. I mean, we're still seeing the same rate, but I'll give you an example of how bad it is. When this all happened, he was being interviewed, kind of like when all the interviews you've done to date. Well, he was getting bombarded by all these news stations in Canada and the U.S., and they were interviewing. Well, he was on holidays in Palm Springs. So he sends out the letter that he goes on holidays, and like every day he's
doing Skype
calls. Every day. And he says, when this was all happening, my email was getting flooded, and one of the emails I got was from a parent. And the parent said, and I'm not kidding you, says, my God-given right to abuse officials. I was like, what? And everybody in the room, there's like 125 executive members from all these associations. We're all, what? So I didn't share that with anybody, but that's what I'm dealing with. And there's some people, can you change them? Probably not. Can you say, hey, you know, you're not welcome at our facility? Probably yes. The sad thing is when it's a parent and their kid gets caught in that crossfire, and that's where, you know, it's unfortunate because they're taking it over to the extreme, but it is, again, the 5 to 10%. It's not the majority. So how do we empower the silent majority to say to these parents, hey, you know, your behavior is not really appropriate? Is that kind of where you're going with a field marshal?
Yeah, concept? No, you're exactly right. So it's funny. you have to identify, I call them the 2%. And I actually call the 2% of people that make youth sport toxic, we call them cheeseburgers on the offside page. And people ask all the time, why do you call them cheeseburgers? Well, because I can't call them assholes on the Facebook page. So it's the 2% of parents that are usually sitting in the chair, in the shade, probably haven't ran a 100-yard dash since they were in high school, living vicariously through their kids. Those are the ones that are typically doing the screaming and the yelling and the taunting and the toxic verbal vomit. And so I identify those as the 2% by calling them the cheeseburgers. The other people, and I tell people this all the time, if you're watching the 2%, the cheeseburgers, if you're watching them partake in verbal official abuse or adding cancer to the event, then as an adult, you should, instead of just turning a blind eye, simply walk over and say, hey, we have youth officials today, or hey, no official is perfect, or hey, would you mind stopping? I'm trying to enjoy my game and you're not. Okay, so a lot of people are uncomfortable doing that, but that's the first step. The second step is, you don't know what happens when you take this phone and then you point it at the person doing this. You don't have to say a word. Just do that. Guess what? When that person sees that, one of two things happen. They either go, okay, this is gonna end up somewhere on YouTube, I don't really wanna be on YouTube, so I'm gonna stop. Or the second thing, which I've also seen happen, it becomes an ambush. You recording me? I didn't tell you you could record me.
Yeah.
Slap the phone out of their hand. You know, and I've seen both cases. But, you know, for the silent, what you call the silent majority, it's almost just as ridiculous to sit there, especially when you have a youth referee. And by the way, most games, most young U14 and below games have a youth referee, regardless if it's hockey, soccer, basketball, football, has a youth referee, sometimes the entire crew. So when you have a 35, 45, 55, 65-year-old man or woman assaulting verbally a youth referee, and you're sitting there watching it, well, you're just as bad as the perpetrator. So either stand up, say something, stand up, get the phone and record, stand up and go get the field marshal. But sitting there is adding nothing to it.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate. And probably the worst example that I had to deal with, it's a long-winded story, but I'll cut really to the chase. I was coaching an Adam age group, 9-10-year-old team many, many years ago, and we were in a tournament, and two of the players skated into each other, fell down. We were worried about concussions, whatever the case may be. The coach of the opposing team, for some reason, got in his head that my young player, who was the smallest kid on my team, intentionally skated into his player, and I was like, okay, and he just lost it, like literally lost it. It got to a point where he took up one of the player's sticks, he threw it at me, and I'm just like, what is this? And then the officials were really beside themselves. They were 12 years old, first-year officials. It was an Adam age group game. And because he was going at it so hard, they ended up taking my player into the penalty box, and they were going to give him a penalty for roughing or whatever the case would be. The coach ends up, and this guy was like almost probably, he was 6'5" and probably 300 pounds. Big, big guy. He steps on the ice and he walks all the way across the ice to the official and he's screaming at the top of the lungs. Well, meanwhile, the parent groups, both mine and the other parent groups, start going crazy. Like, it was just an absolute chaos. When I went to the tournament directors afterwards, said those officials, young officials, were abused. The point, they had to make a decision to throw my player out of the game. Well, you know, we didn't see it. I'm like, well, you know what? I got all these parents are saying this happened. The coach never got suspended. He kept coaching. And probably the hardest thing I ever had to do in my many years of coaching is when you shake hands at the end of the game. This was actually a tournament game for a bronze medal, shaking his hand. And my assistant coach goes, calm down, calm down. I'm like, but that was ridiculous. Like, that was unacceptable. Yeah. So, yes, it's parental behavior. We all have also seen it from coach behavior. It's changing slowly but surely, but I don't think it's happening fast enough. And we mentioned earlier, hockey was the worst, the videos you received. How many videos you received to date, and what percentage of those videos would be hockey and or the other top, say, two sports?
Yeah, no. So I have over 6,000 videos currently. I haven't posted all those videos, so I haven't had to pay on all those videos. But basketball is, I would say, out of the 6,000 videos, I would say a majority of the videos are from basketball, youth basketball. I would say hockey is probably third or fourth on the list. It goes basketball, soccer, wrestling, and then I would probably say hockey/football at that point in time. It's funny, you know, I've never been around hockey. I live in the southern part of the country, and, you know, it's warm here a lot. Hockey just isn't big here. But I've learned that that sport is very physical, and there is tremendous passion, more so from the parents than the actual players. The players look like they're just out there skating and playing hockey and having a good time and trying to win. The parents, from the videos that I've been able to watch, are completely a different level of parent. They're completely out of control. They're completely verbal. They're very abusive. And they're the videos that I have that are most physical. Almost every hockey video I get is a parent being physical with either a coach or an official or another parent. Most of the soccer and the basketball videos I get is a lot of screaming. Some fight, but a lot of screaming. Hockey, I'm shocked at the ignorance and the level of audacity from hockey parents.
Wrestling goes in that list, in the top four. I'm like, what? Like, that was immediately, okay, hockey, soccer, basketball. What about football? I'm talking money sports.
Football? No, football, it's you would think it would have been as physical as like hockey is.
Yeah.
That I would have but I don't. Most of the football videos I get are coaches fighting other coaches, which is bizarre. But yeah, football's not it's not a big pool for as far as videos that I've gotten.
It's interesting because I would think of the videos. I mean, hockey doesn't surprise me because it's a money sport. Basketball is a money sport. Baseball and football are also money sports. When I say money sports, those are meal ticket sports, right? Those are the ones where parents are investing significantly in their son or daughter.
Right.
They're going into the early specialization path because they think their kid is going to either get an NCAA Division I scholarship or potentially play professionally for millions and millions of dollars. So that to me is one of the reasons why parents do take it to that level. But wrestling, I'm just kind of like surprised. So they just, what do they do with these videos in wrestling?
So a lot of it is adrenaline based. Like a lot of these people, I think it's the one sport where they do live vicariously through their kid. And these players are on the mat. These wrestlers are on the mat, borderline fighting. And I think your adrenaline is so high in the moment that you become them. You want to make the moves for them. You want all the calls to go your way. You're completely biased to your child. It's a singular sport. So now that person is singularly dominating your player, basically you, your kid. And you become, I think emotions overtake the sport. And then I think when you've had enough and you can't do anything about it, you lash out. And you lash out to the official. There's one video. Oh my gosh, it's one of the worst videos. In fact, I didn't even post the video. I just posted a screenshot. A coach is so upset with his wrestler that he picks the wrestler up. He's like a 12-year-old kid, picks him up by his neck and takes his feet off the ground. I saw this video. I was so appalled. Like I literally called the state association and the tournament director myself. And I said, please tell me you have this video and you're doing something about it. And they did, and they were, and I haven't followed up with them. This was a couple of weeks ago, but they took it very, very serious. They were completely embarrassed, and But I don't know. I don't know what happens when we as spectators lose all sense of decency towards other humans. We lose all sense of common sense. All for that moment, whether it's a victorious moment or a failure, we're so sucked into that moment that the moment becomes bigger and more, it just becomes bigger than we are. And we don't, as the spectator, we don't manage ourselves. And so we become a sideshow to the moment. And that's what we have to get away from.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree with you more. So one of the things I did recently, I was asked by a sports organization how they can attract and retain their officials, because one of the biggest challenges we're facing is the attrition. So what are some suggestions you have for those organizations that are trying to reverse the trends, you know, get them into the pipeline? Because one of the biggest challenges with the attrition, especially aging population, a lot of those officials that have been in the pipeline for a long time, they're now retiring, and we need to kind of keep that pipeline going. So what's the tips you have for those organizations?
It's very simple, Glenn. They have to know you have their back. You know, if you find, I've been fortunate. I've got good games, and I've got good assigners, and I've got good relationships, and I know when I walk onto a pitch most of the time that the people I'm representing, not just the people that wear the badge like I do, but the people that put me in that spot have my back. I know that if I have any issues, my back is covered. So for an official, especially a young official, that's extremely important. How do you do that? You have to verbally say so. You know, whenever you've got a bunch of officials, let's say you've got a basketball tournament and it's the first day and you're the tournament director. You know what? You go into that room where all 100 officials are and you say, hey, my name's Brian Barlow. I'm the tournament director. First off, I'm super excited that you guys are here today. I want you to know there's going to be some screaming and yelling going on today, and we're going to take a little bit of it, but we're not going to take a lot. You know why? Because I appreciate each and every one of you. I appreciate what you bring. And guess what? You guys passed the test. You guys had the badge. You guys know more than they know. So I'm going to take your side today. All right. I'm going to take your side. If you have any problems, any issues that need to be managed or handled beyond what you need to handle on the court, you let me or one of my staffers know, and we will handle it. We're going to take your word for it. You don't know how many games I've done where the people in charge will say, I don't care what happens, whatever you need, you let us know. Okay, I don't need the help. I need these young officials, these inexperienced officials, to know that you have their back. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is really, really, really simple, Glenn. Feed them. Give them good food. Don't just grab a bunch of sandwiches from the closest sandwich spot. You know, it's so funny. I'll be in a room full of top-level referees, and if the tournament or whatever event that we're doing, if they bring in a catered meal where there's like Schaefer dishes and you know someone's putting the food on your plate, you don't know how much the refs talk about that. They're like, oh my God, we have like a home cooked meal. I mean, it's like gold to us. So a long story short, it really boils down to two things: letting them know that you have their back at all costs. Okay, and feed them. And don't just feed them paper bag stuff. Anybody can do that. Feed them good stuff.
That's hilarious. It's kind of reminds me of, I was asked to do evaluations for a few years in hockey. And it was always great when we actually brought in food for us, because we'd be there for like 6-7 hours, right? Right. It's kind of ironic. Yeah, you're right. The little things matter. They really do matter. And a lot of organizations don't understand the little things matter. So what about pay? Because that is something that comes up. And when I went and did this talk, if people are doing it for the love of the game, they get into it, they stay in it because they love the game. So you see the passion from you. Is pay really that kind of deal breaker for the, you know, the $20, $30 per game? Or should that be just kind of like a reward for doing and being official? What else can they get in terms of intrinsic motivation for officials?
Well, you know, there's two types of officials, and there really are. There's the officials that are out there to make the money, and then there's the officials that are out there for the love of game. And you need both. You can't survive on just one of those. But I will say this: pay is important to both sides. What happens is the good refs, the really good refs, are going to go where they're valued the most. And how they know they're valued the most, whether you like it or not, comes in the form of how much dollars are attached to that event, that game. So the good refs that are qualified to make more money are obviously going to do games where they make more money. The refs that are going out there and they're doing it for the money, they don't care. They just want quantity of games. They want a lot of games because they want to make a lot of money. And so what happens is a lot of times those type of refs aren't of the higher caliber. They're out there chasing games to get money, right, while the other refs are yes, they get paid more, but they're also, you know, like I go to several fitness, I have to pass several fitness tests every year. Like there's probably three or four weekends I'm doing fitness. There's two or three weekends I'm doing upgrade training. There's three or four weekends where I'm having nothing but assessments done. So like I have a quarter to 33% of my year devoted to just maintaining and upgrading my standards as far as how I want to operate as a referee, my fitness level, my training, upgrading my training, becoming better, all that kind of stuff. So there's a cost to that. So I want games that are going to pay me more so I can validate that training. And so it really boils down to what level of referee are you? And what do you want to do with it? So I love the game, but I also love fitness and I also love Mexican food. And so if I didn't ref soccer, I would probably be about 250 to 300 pounds, but I love Mexican food. So I ref soccer so I can eat and the money's good too.
That's a great motivator. So in terms of helping these young officials, particularly the ones that are kind of coming to the pipeline, you kind of touched on in terms of your development and the commitment that you make to multiple weekends for all the stuff that you need to do to stay at the level that you're at. Ongoing professional development is kind of becoming a hot topic in Canada because we have the Coach Association of Canada. In order to maintain your certification for coaching, you have to get X number of professional development credits over the course of time. I don't know if that's in play for officiating, but I think lifelong learning is probably, you know, in order to become the best you can be, you have to continue learning. So what can we do to help young officials get better and also deal with the confrontation that they may or may run up against?
This is probably the best question you've asked, and you've asked some really good questions. I understand the other side of this argument. And what a lot of the people, especially even on my offside page, don't understand is, I'm a parent. I'm a coach. I'm an administrator. I'm a parent. I'm an official. There are four to five pillars of being involved in youth sports, and I've held every position. And so I get all angles of it. But you're right. I get being frustrated as a spectator or a parent at an official. Either the official's out of position, the official didn't see something that we thought was fairly obvious. You don't feel like the official's running as much as he should. The official just went the wrong direction on a call. The official made a mistake. I get all those things can happen, okay? So what I've done is I've actually created, so understanding that there's two sides to this, we have some really bad officials. People get mad at me for saying it. I don't really care. It's reality. We have really bad officials sometimes. And we either have to make them better or have a system where we get rid of them. And so what I've done is the other side of the offside page is actually an academy called Offside Academy. And it's the first, because what happens is we put these officials out, especially these young officials, we put them in a classroom for 2 days. We tell them exactly all the laws of the game. And then if they pass the test, they get to go out next weekend and ref a game. But no one tells them about the situational awareness of being a referee. No one tells them the ins and outs of how to manage adults. No one, I mean, can you imagine being 14 years old and having a fight break out between a parent and a coach or a parent and another parent at 14? on the pitch, I mean, you're going to be like, oh, no, I'm going to clubhouse. Bye. We don't give them enough to be successful. So what Offside Academy is it's literally curriculum, online curriculum, to where the referee who has his badge or her badge can go on and go, okay, here's all the stuff they didn't tell me. Here's how to manage what we call ask, tell the Smith. Here's how to manage building a wall for a player or a team that's asked for 10 yards. All those things that aren't really taught in the classroom, there'll be a place for it. And then also on the Offside page, I do Offside Academy quick hits where I give these, you know, like they don't teach this in referee school, but the most powerful whistle, the most important whistle of any game is the first whistle. But no one says that.
Yep.
But why is it? Especially as a young referee. You know, if you grab, I'm looking if I have my whistle. If you grab your whistle and you're a young referee and you go out there and you point and you barely blow it, where they're going to go, everyone around, the coaches, the players, the parents, I'm like, okay, this referee. But if you go out there and you stand strong, you blow the whistle hard and long and you point and you've got the body language to go with the long heart, guess what that indicates? Okay, this referee probably knows what he's doing. It's all perception based.
Yeah.
But we don't teach that. So I do these little quick hits on to help young, inexperienced referees understand that they have the power, but we don't do a good job of giving them the tools to succeed. We simply give them a test and we pop a badge on their shirt and we say good luck, and then a year later their name's not on the list because they didn't re-register, and we wonder why.
Yeah, and it's very similar to the coaching world where take the clinic, you said you head off to the Wolves, and I mean, there is now a lot of incremental certification that is being added. The challenge that I run into as a running clinics, one of my many hats, I'm a Hockey Canada facilitator, and I've had a lot of coaches come in and say, hey, you know, this is actually getting to the point where I don't know if I'm going to keep coaching because there's almost too much. But then I counter back and say, well, think about volunteer firemen, how much certification they have to do. And yourself, you were just saying how many weekends you commit to a year. When you commit to coaching, you're committing to help kids become the best they can be, develop them into better people. So by just taking a weekend clinic, you know, you got to recognize that there's a lot more to coaching, a lot more to officiating, and it's kind of a two-way street. So committing to your craft and becoming the best you can be will in turn help others. So one of the challenges that happens, and you mentioned a lot, is the how. You know, how to engage parents, how to deal with confrontation, which is what referees are having to deal with. So that's a lot of what you're doing through your Offside training module.
Yep, absolutely.
How well received has it been? Like, are people signing up for it in droves?
Not yet, but I don't have all my pieces together yet, so I'm kind of slowly putting it out there. But yeah, the response that I have on the pieces that we have been pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. You would think that every referee that takes the sport serious would be, you know, would want it immediately. But, you know, in the referee world, it's political too. There are some referees out there that have ego problems, as you probably well know. And, you know, they don't like the fact that some other referee is getting all this attention. And so there's some political bullshit that goes on with this whole thing. But I mean, it comes with the territory. I've always, you know, my whole thing is if you're not making waves and you're not pissing somebody off, then you're not trying hard enough. And so that's kind of always been my motto personally and professionally. And so it doesn't bother me. But at the end of the day, you know, there's just too many people out there that want to talk about the issues. There's just too many people that want to point fingers. And there's just too many people that want to have committee meetings. And there's just too many people that want to dance around the issue and not rub anybody the wrong way. And I'm just not that guy. You know, I don't, you know, people get, you know, mad at me on the Offside page because I'll say something they don't like. I'm like, listen, I didn't ask you to follow me. Don't follow me. If you don't like it, don't follow me. I don't need you. Whether I have 50,000, 100,000, 500,000 or one, my stance isn't going to change. This issue is going to take a great magnitude of people being bold enough to say enough is enough. We have to change the dynamics. If we want youth sports to be what it's truly supposed to be about, which is the innocence of purity of development for everyone involved, including the coaches, including the referees, including the players, and even to some extent, the parents. If the parents would just shut up and watch and listen and stop talking and pointing and acting like they're experts to everything that's in front of them, they too might be able to take a moment and learn. And I'll give you a prime example of this. I was coach 4 years ago to my kid, and we had a soccer team that hadn't lost in two seasons, almost 2 years. And this middle of the road team came up to us on a Saturday at 3 o'clock, and we thought we're going to walk all over this team. We'd beat them twice before. Well, guess what? They put it to us. My parents were shocked. I was shocked. My players were shocked. It was 0-0. 3 or 4 minutes left in the second half. We're taking shot after shot. Nothing's going in. They go down the field, take this great shot. The ball goes in. The other team's parents explode in excitement. The players explode in excitement. I told my boys, get the ball. Let's go. Get the ball and play. Okay. Three whistles. 2 minutes later, three whistles. Game's over. World Cup galore. And I watched my parents, and they were starting to say snarky things. And my boys' heads were down. And I looked at everybody. And it really just, I just took a moment. And I looked. I'm like, no, we're not doing this. And so I grabbed my boys and said, boys, follow me. And I go, parents, no more. And we walked across the pitch where the celebration was going, where everybody was hugging and throwing ice and Gatorade and the big celebration. And we stood there. And the coach looks at me and kind of like, what are you doing? I go, hey, coach, would you mind if I said a few things? I just want to congratulate your team. He goes, no, go ahead. I mean, they knew that we were the best team up to that point. I said, hey, boys, I want to let you guys know that we haven't lost a game in almost 2 years. And you guys put it to us today. And my boys, we're going to try harder and we're going to work harder. And we can't wait to meet you up on the pitch again. And you might beat us again, but we can't wait to play you. You guys deserve all the celebration. And we want to applaud you. And they applauded. And those parents that were celebrating stood there in awe. My parents behind me started to applaud with them. And to this day, when I see those parents or that coach on a soccer pitch, they still grab me and hug me. And they tell me how big that moment was for them and how they now change the way they win or lose. And those parents thanked me. They thanked our players. So we went from having a divided game or a divided moment of, well, they're the winners and they're the losers. And instead, we had a moment of, this is sports. We can take this moment of failure and make it a victory. We can learn by the moment, even as parents. And so even my own parents said, you know what? I was so pissed. I was wondering what you were doing going over there. He goes, but I get it. Parents have to understand and realize it is not your moment. You have to sit back, stop, and listen. Let the kids have their moment. And if you're wise, and if you're open-minded enough, you too could have your own learning moment by watching your kids.
Yeah, that's a great example, because one of the things that I share out all the time is, and my mother was kind of the driver for this, and is the importance of just love watching them play. And really, from a coach perspective, over the years, you know, first 5 years, I was like a lot of other coaches, you know, I was trying to do a lot of coaching during games. And then I thought back on my youth sports experience. I played everything, like everything under the sun, a lot of free play, unorganized, won provincials in three different sports. And I look back at my sports experience, and what did my mother do? She cheered on everybody. She was cheering when the officials made great calls, the other teams. You know, I'm like, I'd go to her after a game and go, Mom, why are you cheering the other teams? She goes, because I just love watching you play, and I love sports. And then I was like, that is kind of the model.
We need more of your mama, Glenn.
Yeah.
We need more of your mama.
I was like, well, where are all those people? They're cheering on the game. That just cheer on the kids for the moment. It's their journey. It's their experience. And it's being soured, unfortunately, by many of the adults in the space, whether it be parents or coaches, sometimes officials.
Or administrators.
And we have to kind of think about, why are we all in this? We're all in this so the kids can have the best quality youth sports experience possible. So they look back at their youth sports experience and they continue being active well into their adulthood. And the example that you kind of shared, I've always been a big believer. I learned this from a lot of my coaches. I had a lot of great coaches growing up. Winning with humility and losing with dignity. And you shared an example where anybody can lose on any given day. And we recently found that out in the Stanley Cup playoffs, where you saw, you know, the two top teams getting knocked out in the first round, one of them being swept. Like, it's perfect example. Just because you're that top dog doesn't mean you're going to continue being that top dog. You may get out coached, you may be out played. But when you leave the field, no one should know whether you won or lost. That was the thing that all of my coaches told me. You should hold your head high, whether you won or lost. Treat it as a learning experience. And I think through failure, if it is a safe-to-fail environment, which it isn't currently for officials and for a lot of players, even for coaches who are learning, we really need to curb that behavior so that it is safe for everybody. You couldn't have nailed it better, and it's a great way to kind of wrap up. But I've just got some rapid-fire questions to kind of throw. Insight. Do you have any books? So you have coach, now you're officiating. Do you have any books that you would recommend for coaches?
Yeah, I wish I'd known that. I don't remember the title, but one guy, when I was on this big press tour, he written a book. I'll have to email this to you. I don't remember the name of it, but it's a pretty good book.
Cool. We'll tag it on the bottom. What about parents? Because you're in the space now that you're kind of addressing, what could you share with parents from a resource or a book to help them kind of bring the behavior down?
I'm not trying to pub myself, but I'm actually in the process of writing a book of basically 100 ways to ruin your child's sporting experience. And it's based on the experiences I've seen and witnessed and have, and the experiences that have been sent to me. And it's basically just a showcase book. It's going to be a showcase book on what not to do as a helicopter parent.
Yeah, which is snowplower, lawnmower, helicopter, you know, and right. The sad thing is, and it's unfortunate because everybody's trying to keep up with the Joneses, but youth sports has become so expensive. I kind of understand why parents' expectations are so high. Because, you know, when you're paying $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 for your kid to play a sport, that's a lot of money. And it's an investment. You want a return on investment. But the other side of the coin is, if you're just keeping up with the Joneses and the kid's not really loving the experience, it's not really, you know, you're looking at.
Well, and I tell people this all the time, just because you spend $15,000 to $20,000 a year does not give you the VIP ticket to treat other human beings like the way that they're treating people. And it's like getting to fly first class. You still have to act a certain way to get to sit in first class. In fact, I tell competitive parents this all the time. There's more pressure on you to act better than everyone else. You're paying more. That doesn't mean you're better, but it does indicate that you should have a better mindset of the sport. It's like someone sitting in first class. They're not better than the people behind them, but there's a certain behavior that you have to act in first class. So I would tell anyone that, you know, spending $15,000, $20,000 a year on sports, you should act better. Don't expect more. You should act better. And the fact of the matter is, you know, if you took that $15,000 and $20,000 that you spend for 10, 11, 12 years for your kid to play, your kid doesn't need a scholarship. In fact, have them go learn a musical instrument instead, take that money and pay college. How about that? So an official is not responsible for your kid getting a scholarship. No scholarship has ever been won or lost based on an official's decision or non-decision. And it certainly doesn't give you the right to act like an asshole, or what we call cheeseburgers on the offside page.
Yeah, great way to end it. So last question, what can organizations do so that kids love the game more at the end of the season than they did at the beginning?
Make it fun. And it goes back to one of the first things we talked about, make the parents shut up. That's the worst thing that kids dislike about their games is their parents' control and words at their games. And they're not powerful enough. The kids aren't powerful enough or savvy enough with their words to tell their parents to shut up. So the clubs, unfortunately, need to put a memorandum out that says, listen, you cannot coach from the sideline. It has to be one of those expectation things. That's the first and foremost. But then make the sport fun. Like treat the, whether it's a tournament or whether it's a season of games, you know, do special things. Have themed events. You know, have a Saturday, like a silent Saturday where no one can speak. Have circus Saturday where you bring out some food trucks and some carnival rides or some horses to ride on and make it look like there's a spectacle. Because guess what? Now we're at a soccer game and a circus. And how awesome is that? You know, we've taken the fun out of sports because we're so worried about the bottom line and registration fees and the power of who's making the decisions that we have no one with a big vision. We have no one with a vision of what youth sports is. And youth sports is about innocence and the purity of the moment and development and fun and making the kids want to come back for more. And we forget to market it. If we just market it, the kids will want to come back. And if the kids want to come back, the parents will pay for it. But we're so narrow-minded. We're so tunnel vision into power and money and registration that we forget the moment ourselves. And we put people in charge that are tunnel vision, that are fiscally making decisions and not thinking about the number one thing that they should be thinking about, which is the product. And the product is what? The kid and the game. And that's ultimately the only thing that we should be thinking about. And then once we start thinking about that, then our mind becomes wider and we can start thinking big picture. But when's the last time that you walked up to a sporting event and it felt fun? Probably a long time, right? So, and I would say this to close too. I would love to have a conversation with you and whoever you said had the idea of the no parents weekend. That's something I've actually considered here on stateside. Number one, because I think the game, I think it would actually make people think to shut up. Number two, I think it would cause a ton of press from a stateside point of view. And then number three, I just think that there's lessons learned from something like that. So I was very intrigued when you were talking about that. So I would definitely carry on that conversation or speak out about that and at a future time. So
yeah, no, that'd be great. But in terms of that kind of last takeaway, you kind of nailed it on the head. One of the quotes that I share all the time, and they, a lot of people think I'm just about fun. I'm probably one of the most competitive people on the planet. I do not like losing, even in board games. It's just one of those things. But I will never compromise that element of fun and enjoyment and positivity for the kids. So the quote I've shared with everybody, kids play sports because they're fun. They quit when they're not. It's not rocket science. And you kind of nail it on the head. The organizations, and they're all concerned about attrition, but what they've completely forgotten about is it's not about them. It's about the kid. And if you zero in on their experience and them being the avatar, and maybe look at youth sports as the video game industry has done, make it safe to fail, do the market research, ask them what they want. Do they want
great analogy?
All of a sudden, whoa, your attrition rate just shifts. And you treat it like a business model instead of a not-for-profit. You've got to bring it into perspective. Why do these kids play? Because they enjoy it. They're social. They're friends. All this other stuff in lieu of working the sport where it's really been driven from specialization and travel ball and all the money that's come into play. I love this conversation. I love to hook you up with the other people, and that was just amazing. You know, keep up the great work, and it'd be interesting to see how fast the tables turn and the needle moves, because attrition is an issue at the youth sports level. It's an issue at the official level. And even at the coaching level, there's a lot of coaches now that are kind of like the volunteer pool is getting smaller and smaller because of, you know, the challenges that we're facing in the youth sports segment. So it's not going to happen overnight, but I'm sure hope that it's going to turn back to the good old days. It won't get back to pre-internet, pre-digital era, but hopefully kids enjoy the game and love the game again like we did when we grew up.
Hey, it's going to take people like you and I and our colleagues to make this thing happen. So I appreciate you having a voice out there as well. Let me know if I can ever help you in any way. And I appreciate you inviting me on the show.
Yeah, that was great. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us this week. You can find us on Facebook for Love of the Game, Twitter, and for loveofthegame.ca. We'll see you next week for an all-new episode.